Nehemiah, chapters 1 through 4. The fifth talk in a series on Ezra and Nehemiah was presented by Gil Greco on August 23, 2020, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gil Greco. This recording is being made available to you by Gutenberg College, a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. This recording was taken from a talk originally streamed online. Ezra and Nehemiah, handout number 3, accompanies this talk.
All right, let's get started. We are starting the portion of this book that we're reading, which is referred to in English Bibles as Nehemiah. Think of it like 2 Kings, sort of. It's the second part of the same book. We've seen in thus far in Ezra and Nehemiah that despite God's continued graciousness, the people's hearts have not been changed, and their rebellion continues. This is especially insulting because God has brought them out of Persia in a second exodus, which, unlike the first exodus from Egypt, God actually had to forgive them for the sin they committed that took them into Persia in the first place. We saw last week that the rebellion that the people had was manifested in people marrying foreign wives, whose countries and culture were characterized by their abominations, which ultimately boils down to not solely worshiping Yahweh. Ezra mandated that the people must divorce their foreign wives. The text of what we call Ezra ends on the dour note that some of those wives had children. I think this goes to what I was just saying about how things aren't unambiguously good and there isn't a right side of history. It may have been what was required of them. It may have been the right action for the people to get divorced at that time. But there were consequences to that. And there were women and children who were hurt because of that. And history is an attempt to tell a story about the past. And unfortunately, the reality of reality and of the past is that it's tragic. It's not just people doing the right thing. It's people, what does Paul say, grasping after God, groping after God, and they make a mess of things as they do it. We will see in this next section sort of a parallel to the second Exodus. I've been saying all along that there's 5 sections to Ezra and Nehemiah. The first and third section are sort of parallel to each other. The second and fourth section are parallel to each other. And then we have a fifth section, which sort of wraps up the whole book. So we saw in Ezra that God was gracious through the second Exodus. We're going to see God being gracious to Nehemiah and what he's going to do in Nehemiah's life. There are reasons to believe that Nehemiah is modeling his account off of the book of Joshua. Even if that's not the case, we see God being gracious to the people of Israel by furthering their purposes and not allowing what their enemies are doing to them to sort of have as dire consequences as they could have. And then in the next few weeks, once we get past this section, we will see again the sin of the people and the rebelliousness of the people and how that's still at work, even though they've been constantly upheld by God. All right. So I sent out a handout. We're in Nehemiah. I'm going to be in paragraph 52. If you're following along in a regular Bible, this is Nehemiah 1, 1 through 3. The words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah. Now it happened in the month of Kislev, in the 20th year, while I was in Susa, the capital, that Hanani, one of my brothers, and some men from Judah came, and I asked them concerning the Jews who had escaped and had survived the captivity, and about Jerusalem. They said to me, "The remnant there in the province who survived the captivity are in great distress and reproach, and the wall of Jerusalem is broken down, and its gates are burned with fire." Okay, so the first thing that happens is we get a note from the editor, from the final compiler of this work. That could be Nehemiah, that could be Ezra, as I've said. We're not sure who this ends up being. Could be the chronicler, the author of Chronicles. And it just notes that these are the words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah. So the whole section that we're going to read today and into some of the sections we'll get into in the following weeks, those are all diary. These are all diary entries, essentially, from Nehemiah himself. And he talks about himself in the first person, unlike Ezra, who has momentary sort of, and then I prayed, and he describes his prayer. But then the rest of the time is sort of describing what happened to Ezra. This is just straight up Nehemiah's account of what happened. So it's the 20th year. We know from chapter 2, which we'll get to in a little bit, that Artaxerxes is the king right now. So if we assume that this is talking about Artaxerxes' 20th year, then we're in 445 BC. For reference, Ezra came to Jerusalem around, he came in the 7th year, so 13 years earlier, so 458 BC, and Ezra was 50 to 60 years after Zerubbabel and Joshua. So this is 70-ish years after the generation of Zerubbabel and Joshua. Anyhow, he's visited by Hanani, who could actually be his sibling, his blood brother. But the word is flexible enough that it could mean kinsman. I don't think we have enough information about his biography or who Hanani's father was to be able to say for sure. Nehemiah asks Hanani about how Jerusalem and the exiles are. Hanani tells him that the remnant are in great distress and reproach because Jerusalem has been desolated. So this phrase remnant, I'm sure you've run into it before. It's this idea of the people who are left over. This is what Ezra had talked about. There's people left over. You could have destroyed everybody because they're well deserving of your destruction, but there are some people left over. And this remnant is usually refers to the people who are living in Jerusalem. So the people who are living in Jerusalem are greatly distressed. They're under they're under a lot of stress and reproach. And reproach is this idea that they have something to be ashamed of. They have something that marks them in their region as people to be ashamed of. You might think of the way that Americans talk about hillbillies or things of that nature, that there's certain regions, or we talk about the Rust Belt, right? There's certain regions of the country that, oh man, bad stuff really happened to them. And so at the moment, Jerusalem is one of those places. It's one of the places where the surrounding society thinks of it in a very negative way. Because it's so weak that the walls and gates are broken down and burned with fire. So I want to take a minute and try to construct a picture of what might have happened. We know for sure in Ezra 4, there's an exchange between some of the Sumerians, and King Artaxerxes, where King Artaxerxes. They write to King Artaxerxes and they say, King, they're rebuilding the city. They're really bad. If you let them rebuild this city, they're just going to cause trouble for you. King Artaxerxes writes them back and says, well, yeah, I see that they cause trouble, but I do see that they have been brought to heel on occasion. So you go ahead and stop them from building, and I will make a decree at some point. And then we are told, and this is a quotation from Ezra 4, then as soon as the copy of King Artaxerxes' document was read before Rehum and Shimshai the scribe and their colleagues, they went in haste to Jerusalem to the Jews and stopped them by force of arms. So that is some information that we know for sure. Now I'm going to wildly speculate for a little bit and try to present to you a plausible explanation of all of the information we have thus far in Ezra and Nehemiah about the chronology of what's happening. History is funny in that it can be very simple or it can be very complicated, and I am just trying to account for all of the pieces that I have in front of me. If we found some, you know, an archaeological site and there were, you know, tablets or papyrus or something that was an account of what happened in the Sumerian region around the Jews and what all was going on, then I would be up for changing this. I'm not married to this, but I want to give some kind of idea of a possible recounting of what happened through this time of Ezra and Nehemiah. I think it's safe to say that in every generation you have sort of more revolutionary folks and more conservative folks. So probably before the time of Ezra, there's a generation that comes up. They are very interested in restoring sort of traditional Jewish ways of thinking as a group, right? We know as the history goes on, as we get more and more information, that the Jews were not just all good the way that they are depicted in the end of the prologue, right? At the end of the prologue, they're all celebrating Passover. Everybody's pure. Everyone has cleansed themselves from the outside nations and so on. But the fact that people have married foreigners and are taking part in that culture after that time means that, you know, probably from the end of the chapter until that time, it wasn't like they were spotless in between. But that being so, there is probably still a group of people who are interested and possibly can get some traction in restoring sort of traditional, you know, Jewish, they're probably interested in Jewish autonomy, possibly interested in building the wall so they can have religious independence. They don't have to worry about their neighbors, whatever. There's probably lots of complicated reasons. And so probably before the time of Ezra's arrival, there's an attempt by this group of people to improve their fortification. We know that there are political animosities. We saw that with Zerubbabel and the neighbors. But the political animosities that take place during Zerubbabel's time are they're people who are bothered. And then what they do is they go bribe officials to sort of gum up the bureaucracy and keep things from happening. Now, it may be that, you know, opposition to a particular people may go from sort of using bribery to using violence, but it's probably the case that it's a different kind of person whose first reaction is to resort to bribery than it is to their first reaction is to resort to violence. So we don't have people who are temperamentally interested in violently attacking the Jews. They just want to make their lives difficult. And the way they do that is through gumming up the bureaucracy. So when the group of Jews is interested in fortifying stuff, that probably made their neighbors who have this sort of animosity, at least in their memory, if not sort of present with them, that probably made them nervous. We know from other history that at the beginning of Artaxerxes' reign, there were several Greek-sponsored revolts for different cities within the Persian Empire. So there are stirrings all over Persia. Obviously, the beginning of a reign is when you do stuff because that the king has not consolidated power. People don't know what to do. The Greeks have been enemies with Persia for a while. That's going to continue even through Alexander the Great. And the Greeks see opportunities to sort of help local folks out by financing or sometimes helping with actual people, sort of drum up chaos so that Persia has a hard time. And one of the sort of stirrings, revolts that happens is located in Egypt. Now, if you remember the history of the Jews, there is a point in time when King Ahaz, who was the king when Isaiah was one of the kings, when Isaiah was prophesying, he had pursued an alliance with Egypt in order to be safe from a pro-Assyrian coalition that was forming around him. So if Egypt is stirring and the neighbors sort of remember their history, they may be looking at Jerusalem and going, those guys might line up with Egypt, and that wouldn't be good because Egypt is very powerful. They could bring some hurt to bear. They'd hit us before they could get to Persia, so we're in danger here. They might also remember all the way back to the settling of Canaan, which is where the Jews killed everybody, or most of everybody, enough of everybody that you'd be really, really nervous about the Jews sort of pursuing that line of thing. Maybe the instability of the government makes the Jews go, you know, this is our, you know, God-appointed land, and we could just take it now because it's not like Persia can come in and settle everything because they've got Egypt to worry about. They've got bigger issues to worry about. So the neighbors are unsettled because new kings coming into power is an unsettling time, and they are neighbors with the Jews who have a history of doing unsettling things. So these neighbors appeal to Artaxerxes, who is far enough away that he could be a little less immediately concerned with what's happening. He's a little more level-headed than the neighbors. If the Jews did actually do something, Artaxerxes is not immediately threatened by it. So he can afford to be a little bit more, as I say, level-headed. But he does tell them to stop the Jews from working until he can make a decision about what to do next. So this is probably because he wanted to see how the political situation developed. I mean, for all he knows, the Jews are planning to make an alliance with Egypt. He doesn't know. He's going to wait and see. On the other hand, the Jews are nervous because they see how much unrest there is. It's not clear if their neighbors will not use the uncertainty in the political situation to cause chaos, right? If you don't have a government who can enforce what's going on in the local area, then there is the possibility that your neighbors are going to start just taking whatever they can. And that would include whatever they can from Jerusalem. I mean, there's a lot of gold in Jerusalem, a lot of silver, right? We've, in the construction of the temple and things, there aren't walls, and there's a lot of valuable stuff there. So they could have people who, unafraid of government reprisals, might come in and start trying to steal things of value from the temple and from the people in Jerusalem. Now, they are stopped by force of arms. So their neighbors, while they have legal backing from Artaxerxes says, go ahead and stop them. They are using that legal backing as a justification to use violence to cow the Israelites into stopping work. And the Israelites are cowed. This might be part of the reason why the Israelites end up marrying foreign women. They might have wanted to assure their neighbors that they were a part of the provincial program, right? We're part of this region too. Okay. We're not special. We don't think of ourselves as sort of separate or whatever. We're with it. They also probably wanted to have the insurance of being under the protection of more than one god. So the whole situation is leading to their neighbors making bad decisions and them making bad decisions. Now, I'm assuming that everything I've said up to this point is in the first couple of years of Artaxerxes' reign. We know that Ezra starts doing, he arrives in Jerusalem the seventh year of Artaxerxes' reign. So some time passes between all of what I have just speculated went on and when Ezra comes along. Another thing that directs me to thinking that there is some time between when Ezra arrives and actually more specifically when Nehemiah arrives and when this unrest and the consequences of this unrest is going on is because the letter that we get to Artaxerxes about the unrest is by Rehum and Shimshai. And in the next couple of chapters, we're going to meet some folks named Tobiah and Sanballat. Sanballat? I'm not sure how you say that guy's name. And they're different folks. Now, it could be that Rehum and Shimshai are sort of around, and these are just different animosities that are happening. But probably what happened is that we have two different parties. Tobiah and Sanballat are the sort of guys paying attention to the region at the time of Nehemiah, which is, you know, 18 to 20 years after all of this unrest has been happening when Rehum and Shimshai are writing to Artaxerxes. Okay, so in Artaxerxes' seventh year, Ezra comes to Jerusalem and he teaches the Torah. It reminds the people that they need to be singularly devoted to Yahweh. And part of that singular devotion is they can't have this relationship to the people where they are counting on their political alliances for security. Okay, the fear that haunted Ahaz that led him to be seeking alliances with Egypt, the fear that led the people, I'm speculating, to marry foreign wives, is connected to this fear that Yahweh isn't going to take care of me in this situation. I have to do what I can to take care of myself. And in learning the Torah, in Ezra teaching the Torah, he's reminding the people that Yahweh is going to take care of them, but they need to be devoted to him. So as a consequence, they divorce their wives, at least for a period of time. It does end on the dour note of, Ezra does end on the dour note of the wives, some of the wives having children. However, it does seem to present what happened as if they actually did what they set out to do. Probably most of those women who are divorced return to their families in humiliation. The Jews probably start working on building fortifications again so they can be independent in their beliefs, right? If your neighbor is going to insist, like the generation of neighbors at Zerubbabel's time, like the generation of neighbors that all of the neighbors that we saw in Ezra 4, right? They have this animosity to the Jews because the Jews think of themselves as special. And if you're going to have that kind of animosity, one of the way that you maintain your ability to be independent in your beliefs is you have the means to defend yourself against people who oppose that belief. So they start fortifying again so that they can maintain this independence. Now it's at this point that their neighbors, who who are probably spurned on by the embarrassment of all of their daughters who have returned home, try to utterly humiliate them. And the way that they do this is they just break the wall and they fire the gates. That's the language that gets used in Hanani's account to Nehemiah of what happened. So your God, your belief system that you prize so dearly is so weak and so unimpressive. Later in the text, there's a section where they talk about the withering Jews. You are so withering, right? You're so dry. You're so desiccated. You have no substance to you. You're so pathetic that we can just come when we please and do whatever we want to your walls. Keep in mind, by this time, we have a little bit more stability in the land. And there is some precedent for the folks stopping the Jews. However, if their neighbors had attacked and conquered Jerusalem to the extent that they had sacked the temple, taken all of the stuff out, destroyed stuff, that could have been interpreted on the larger political stage as a local rebellion to the Persian Empire, trying to consolidate and amass some power for itself as it starts to position itself to oppose Persia. So they didn't want to do that. If they had utterly sacked Jerusalem, it probably would have read wrong. So they just settle for utterly humiliating the Jews. And they succeed in intimidating the Jews to the extent that they don't want to do anything further. So that was a long digression where I'm sort of trying to reconstruct a plausible explanation for what's happening. The result is, as you recall, that Hanani is telling Nehemiah that the people of Israel who are living in Jerusalem are in great distress because Jerusalem's walls and gates are totally wrecked. All right, paragraph 53. This is 1:4 through 11. Well, most of 11 in your real Bibles. When I heard these words, I sat down and wept and mourned for days. And I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven. I said, I beseech you, O Lord God of heaven, the great and awesome God who preserves the covenant and loving kindness for those who love him and keep his commandments. Let your ear now be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer of your servant, which I am praying before you now, day and night, on behalf of the sons of Israel, your servants, confessing the sins of the sons of Israel, which we have sinned against you. I and my father's house have sinned. We have acted very corruptly against you and have not kept the commandments, nor the statutes, nor the ordinances which you commanded your servant Moses. Remember the word which you commanded your servant Moses, saying, if you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the peoples. But if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, though those of you who have been scattered were in the most remote part of the heavens, I will gather them from there and will bring them to the place where I have chosen to cause my name to dwell. They are your servants and your people whom you redeemed by your great power and by your strong hand. O Lord, I beseech you, may your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant and the prayer of your servants who delight to revere your name, and make your servant successful today and grant him compassion before this man. Okay. This is not as great of a prayer as Ezra 9. I mean, I think it's a very good prayer. It's just shorter. And it basically says two things. The people have sinned, and it seems like we're headed in a direction where you are bringing us back together. Help me as I work towards that. Notice how Nehemiah feels solidarity with his people. This is a hallmark of mediators throughout the Old Testament, right? Moses, when he's at his best, is lumping himself in with Israel. Ezra, when he confesses in Ezra 9, is putting himself in with his people. I didn't actually go and look in Daniel, but I'm sure Daniel does the same thing, where he identifies himself with the whole people. Even though, and we'll speak specifically about Nehemiah in this case, he's not at fault for, I mean, he wasn't there when Moses was giving the commandment, and he wasn't there in the generation that got taken by the Babylonians. He wasn't sinning at that time. He wasn't around to be sinning at that time. And he wasn't in Israel when the events surrounding tentatively constructed, right? The people divorcing their wives. He wasn't a part of that. Nevertheless, he identifies himself with his people. I think that this prayer speaks to the speculation that I am putting forward as to what happened. This is why he's talking about Moses, and if we return to what you've said. In Ezra, we have an example. Ezra just says, we are so evil that if you wiped us off of the face of the planet, you'd be totally justified. And then he does not ask for forgiveness. He just notes that everything they've done is bad. And yet, they have returned to Yahweh by divorcing their wives. That was the idea of the divorces in Ezra. And my assumption is that in talking to Hanani in more detail, in learning more of the circumstances of what's going on, something like what I have reconstructed here is what he's being informed of. And that is the basis on which he's appealing to God. Look, God, we are sinful. We're sinful just this generation. It's not like it was last generation. It's us. We are the ones who are sinful. But we are returning to you. So please, as we're in this process of trying to get back to being your people, please bless the fact that we are returning to you and trying to keep your commandments. Now, it may just be the case that Nehemiah is looking at everything that has happened since the decree of Cyrus, and he recognizes that God is working in history. And he is, we had this period where the people were evil, and now they're sort of returning to God by going and rebuilding Jerusalem and the temple and the altar and, the walls, which is what Nehemiah is going to do, but that we've had a group of people sort of try to do. It could be the case. And if that is the case, he is praying that the humiliation that Jerusalem is currently experiencing is just a hiccup in the process of God sort of bringing them back to what's going on. Obviously, because I came up with the speculation, I think that my picture, the construction that I've made of what's going on, is more likely, but I could be talked out of that. It's interesting that this prayer doesn't take place in time. We're told that it starts at a specific moment when I heard these words. But then we're also told that it goes on for days. So this is like a stream of consciousness sort of thing that is sort of capturing all of the major beats of his prayers during this time from when Hanani tells him what's going on until what happens in the next section. Now it ends with it saying, make your servant successful today and grant him compassion before this man. And the question is, which man are we talking about? We're going to find out that that's King Artaxerxes. And it's interesting because we sort of start the prayer located in one moment, which is right after Hanani tells him. And then the prayer sort of is the major beats of what's happening. And then it ends at a specific moment when he says, help me with what I'm about to say to this man. So this prayer is sort of standing in for who knows how many hours, who knows how many dozens or hundreds of prayers that Nehemiah prayed that were substantively basically this idea. As an aside, I just want to note that the sophistication and complexity of the biblical texts is really astonishing. I think that this is also probably true. It's probably true of a lot of ancient literature that we sort of take for granted. We sort of have, as moderns, we sort of have this view that, like, well, they started out simple and it got more and more complicated. And I think that that's probably not the case. I think, in my understanding of the literature that we have now, I think it's probably only in the last century that we've reached the sort of that we're doing things in our literature that requires the sort of sophistication that you need in order to sort of keep up with what's happening in the Old Testament. He prays this prayer and he just expects you to just like to recognize that this part of the prayer is at the beginning of when he was praying. And this part of the prayer is sort of for this specific moment, and everything else is sort of the stuff that he was thinking about in the meantime. And he just expects you from the context and other things to just get that's what was going on. I think that's, this certainly is not the only example in Ezra and Nehemiah that we've seen. I think the way that Ezra dealt with sort of telling the story of the oppression by the Sumerians is it just knows that you can keep up and just goes full throttle and you figure it out. And I think that that's really astonishing. And I think that coming to the text of the Bible and thinking that we're way more sophisticated than that is silly. There is a book that I really enjoy called Gilead by Marilyn Robinson. And I have talked to several people who've read the book and they don't like it because they don't understand what it's doing. And I think one of the reasons why I really like that book is because I've read Old Testament prophets. Like the time that I picked up Gilead was about the same time that I was reading a lot of Old Testament prophets, and the sort of stream of consciousness sort of just going from one thing to the next, and everything's sort of connected, and everything's sort of about developing themes and a perspective of God and whatever, but it's not linear, and it's not sort of about the plot, it's about other things. And so I think and Gilead was written, you know, in the mid-aughts or the late aughts, so it's only recently that, and probably before then there are books like that, but I only think it's been in the last century or so that we've reached this spot where we can do these sort of stream of consciousness kinds of things and just expect readers to be able to figure out how to keep up. And they already had that going for them in the Old Testament. So, okay. Sorry. That was a rather long digression, but we'll get back to paragraph 54, which is 111 through the end of 111 through 2:1. Now, I was the cupbearer to the king, and it came about in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, that wine was before him, and I took up the wine and gave it to the king. Now, I had not been sad in his presence. So, Nehemiah is a trusted advisor to Artaxerxes. Cupbearers, among other things, are poison testers. I mean, that's part of the reason why you have a cupbearer, and you need somebody who you can trust in that role. Right? If your poison tester is not actually poison testing or is trying to figure ways around that, you know, you are so vulnerable as a person in power. We just have a long history of people who thought they were invincible because they were emperor of the world, and then they got poisoned or killed by their ministers or whatever. Julius Caesar comes to mind. So the cupbearer is this very high position, and that's Nehemiah's job. He has occasion to bring wine to the king. Some commentaries that I've read have the way that they frame what he's doing is that he decides the way to approach the king is to be sad, sort of obviously. So this would mean that Nehemiah had kind of a professional facade or something that he sort of let slip in this case, so that the king would see him in this sort of vulnerable state and talk to him about a personal matter. I think there's some evidence in the next section that gives us a clue that this is not what happened. If any of you have experienced teaching on Ezra and Nehemiah, it's very common for Nehemiah to be the proof text for a new church building. It's very often used as, here is how to be a good sort of business manager person as you're a pastor. So there is a version of the story where Nehemiah decides to be sad in front of the king, where he's being vulnerable, where I don't think that that's despicable. However, the idea that you would use your emotions, or that you would be a consummate professional, and that you would be so calculating that people would never see sort of your authentic self, or that they would never see, I don't know, it bespeaks a particular view of how pastors or business people should conduct themselves that seems a little bit sleazy to me. So let me just read the next section and I'll explain why I think that Nehemiah is not sort of dropping his professional facade here. The king said to me, "Why is your face sad, though you are not sick? This is nothing but sadness of heart." Then I was very much afraid. I said to the king, "Let the king live forever. Why should my face not be sad when the city, the place of my father's tombs, lies desolate and its gates have been consumed by fire?" Then the king said to me, "What would you request?" So I prayed to the God of heaven. I said to the king, "If it please the king, and if your servant has found favor before you, send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tombs, and that I may rebuild it." Okay, so it's interesting that he says, "Then I was very much afraid." If he had been planning on using the tactic of being vulnerable in order to get the king to give him a hearing, it's strange that he would be very much afraid. It seems more likely to me that Nehemiah just notes that he hasn't been sad in the king's presence. The king notices because he's not dumb. And he says, "This is nothing but sadness of heart." He said, the way that this is phrased in the NASB makes it sound, I don't know, it's sort of archaically written, so it makes it sound like it's more profound. I think the substance of what the king is saying is, "Oh, you look sad. You probably have some personal stuff going on, right?" That seems to me the substance of what he's saying. So apparently this word sad, as it's rendered in the NASB, is just bad. Why is your face bad, though you are not sick? So he sort of ruled out this alternative. Well, I know you can't be feeling bad because, I mean, we use that expression, right? You can't be feeling bad because you're sick, because you're not sick. So this must be, you must be having some kind of personal issue. And having a personal issue, you know, if you are trying to be professional, right, being in a situation where someone realizes that you're having a hard time when you're not necessarily sort of interested in being vulnerable with that person can sometimes be very embarrassing. And I think that's the sort of thing that's going on when Nehemiah said, "Then I was very much afraid," right? He doesn't know how the king's going to react here. This isn't a stratagem that he's employed in order to get the king to trust in his vulnerability so he can pitch him, you know, this project, which is often how it's depicted. Rather, he's been praying this prayer for however long. It's something like 4 months between Kislev and Nisan. I think that's like 4 months. So he's been stewing on this for some time, and he's been stewing on it so much that it's sort of affected how he's feeling about things. And so the king sees that he's affected by something, and Nehemiah goes, "Oh no, I didn't mean to sort of to let him know that anything was going on." So he tells him, the king has sort of rightly said what's going on. It looks like you have a personal issue. He says, "Let the king live forever. Why should my face not be sad when the city, the place of my father's tombs, lies desolate and its gates have been consumed by fire? He's like, here's what's bothering me. The city where my father's tombs are, it has been destroyed. Commentators will point out that he doesn't mention Jerusalem, and that this is a tactic to get the king to sort of align himself, you know, empathetically with Nehemiah and then give him what he wants. But he's not mentioning Jerusalem because we know that the king had made orders against Jerusalem. So he's going to get him in his good graces and then he's going to tell him that it's Jerusalem. And they'll even do that with the following verse where he says, send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tombs. And they say, ah, see, he doesn't mention Jerusalem because he's employing the strategy. And I just think this seems like a much more, this is a much more real people thing happening. Obviously, we have some formality to what's going on. He says, let the king live forever. But I think if you can picture someone with this much power who is making themselves available for you to tell them about your personal problems, you would have a little bit of embarrassment about sort of saying, well, here is the issue. Nehemiah does go ahead and do it because I do think, and there's more that we're going to talk about here, I do think that there is an intimate relationship between the king and Nehemiah. Not only is he his cupbearer, I think they have a sort of relationship. I imagine it's the sort of relationship that Cyrus and Daniel had, that, or possibly Nebuchadnezzar and Daniel had, that these, it's, they had a relationship sort of beyond the text that we see in the Bible, and that relationship was a kind of relationship that real people have with each other. So I think Nehemiah really respects Artaxerxes, but the king is inviting him to talk about personal things. So he tells him that his Jerusalem is in distress, and the king says, what would you request? So I prayed to the God of heaven. Now I think this moment where he says, so I prayed to the God of heaven, I think that captures the end of the prayer. So if we're going to locate this prayer in time, even though I said you can't do that, right? When he says, make your servant successful today and give him compassion before this man, I think that piece of the prayer is housed in this moment when Nehemiah says, so I prayed to the God of heaven. So he prays to the God of heaven, and then he turns to the king and says, if it please the king, and if your servant has found favor before you, send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tombs, and I may rebuild it. So he says, I think that I need to go fix this problem personally. Then the king said to me, the queen sitting beside him, how long will your journey be, and when will you return? So it pleased the king to send me, and I gave him a definite time. So notice these details, right? The queen is sitting beside the king. Now we know from Esther that the queen doesn't just hang out with the king when court is in session, right? This is why Esther has to go to Ahasuerus to ask him to come to the dinner with Haman that first time, and why she prays and has the 3 days of fasting and all of that is because it's not normal for her to be around the king. So my suspicion, and I've read a couple of commentators who sort of think of this, is we are getting a clue by talking about the queen sitting beside him that this is not at a party or at a normal function. This is, it's sort of the end of the business day, if you will, and the king is with the queen sort of in their own chambers, and Nehemiah has been invited in to hang out with him. Possibly there are a couple other like intimate friends with these folks, but this is a very sort of closed gathering. This is not the official whatever's going on. And then the king asks him how long he will be gone and when he will return. So clearly the king doesn't want him to be gone forever. The king doesn't think this is the sort of assignment that he can just send him off and, you know, wish him well and never see him again. He wants him to come back. So I think all of those things point to Nehemiah and the king having a special kind of bond that sort of goes beyond, this is one of my most trusted officials. And I said to the king, if it please the king, let letters be given me for the governors of the provinces beyond the river, that they may allow me to pass through until I come to Judah, and a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the fortress, which is by the temple, for the wall of the city, and for the houses to which I will go. And the king granted them to me because the good hand of my God was on me. So we saw when Zerubbabel and Joshua were coming that Cyrus's decree allowed for a grant to be given to them. We saw when Ezra came to Jerusalem that the taxes, the treasury that were collected from taxes from the province beyond the river, were to go to this project of allowing the Jews to worship correctly. So once again, we see that the king of Persia is benevolently disposed towards the Jews, and that's being transmitted through a particular person, right? Nehemiah, he's carrying the letter that says, hey guys, let us have this material that we need in order to work on this project. And he also has letters for the governors beyond the river that will let him get to Judah. So all of the obstacles are sort of being cleared away by, you know, the emperor snapping his fingers. So this is 2:9-10. Then I came to the governors of the provinces beyond the river and gave them the king's letters. Now the king had sent with me officers of the army and horsemen. When Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official heard about it, it was very displeasing to them that someone had come to seek the welfare of the sons of Israel. It's interesting that Nehemiah has a military escort, where Ezra did not. And Ezra specifically talks about he did not ask the king for a military escort because God's hand was on him. Right, he wanted God's protection to be sufficient for the occasion, and so he didn't ask for an escort. But the fact that Nehemiah has a military escort, I think we're supposed to see as a sign that God is moving the heart of Artaxerxes, and that God's hand is on Nehemiah. So it's just interesting when the same thing can for one person be a blessing. Be a sign of blessing, and the opposite thing can also be a sign of blessing. It's just interesting that God works in that way. I probably have more to say about that at the end. Okay, we're introduced to Sanballat and Tobiah, who are going to be the chief antagonists in this part of the narrative. Mostly what they're going to do as we go along is hear about stuff and be displeased, and sometimes they make plans. This is one of the reasons why Nehemiah's account might be modeled after Joshua. In the conquest of Canaan, in the book of Joshua, whoever the next group of Canaanites is, after they take over a city, whoever the next group of Canaanites is often hears what the Jews are doing and they get displeased about it and make plans to do something about it. I will talk a little bit about Nehemiah modeling himself after Joshua at the end. We know that Sanballat the First was governor of Samaria from this thing called the Elephantine Papyri. We don't know, as far as I'm aware, have extra biblical sources about this guy named Tobiah. Now, Tobiah, his name is made out of two words, Tav, which is the generic sort of word for good. And God saw that it was Tav. And then the end there, Ia, is in a lot of names, right? Nehemiah, Azariah, you know, those, all those sorts of things. And that's God's name. So, the sense of his name is Yahweh is good. So that's a particularly Jewish sort of piece of, it's not a suffix exactly. I don't know what the linguistic term for it is, but it's a piece of a name that is a particularly Jewish one, right? Yahweh is the God of the Jews. So to have someone's name be Yahweh is good means they probably have some kind of Jewish thing. We also know from later in Nehemiah that he has connections in Jerusalem. If I'm right in my assessment of what I was talking about last week, you know, there's Paul famously says, not all Israel is true Israel, and what I was saying last week is not all Moab is true Moab. What the thing that matters is not ethnicity, but belief and worship, right? Or conduct. It's, do you behave in a way that says that you are devoted to Yahweh, or do you believe and act as if you are devoted to Yahweh and some other gods, or to only to other gods? So I think the reason Tobiah is called the Ammonite, people argue about why he's called the Ammonite, but if Tobiah really is a key that he is cluing us in that he's at least of Jewish descent, if not a Jew, the appellation the Ammonite would lead us to think that he is religiously an Ammonite, that the way he's conducting himself is like an Ammonite. So these are not good guys, and we'll see that as we go on. All right. So I came to Jerusalem. So this is 2:11 through 16. I came to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. So he's resting. And I arose in the night, I and a few men with me. I did not tell anyone that my God was putting into my mind to do for Jerusalem. And there was no animal with me except the animal on which I was riding. So I went out at night by the valley gate in the direction of the dragon's well, and onto the refuse gate, inspecting the walls of Jerusalem, which were broken down, and its gates, which were consumed by fire. Then I passed on to the fountain gate and the king's pool, but there was no place for my mount to pass. So I went up at night by the ravine and inspected the wall. Then I entered the valley gate again and returned. The officials did not know where I had gone or what I had done, nor had I as yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, or the rest who did the work. Okay, so Nehemiah arrives in Jerusalem. He takes 3 days to rest. Then he secretly goes and inspects what needs to be done with regard to the gate and the walls. He goes out of a western gate. In Jewish culture, the top of the map is east. So he goes out a western gate. He goes in this direction around the city and comes back to the gate he started from. There is a little bit of archaeological information that we have. Apparently one of the walls, we know where it is, but most of these gates and places and things, we're not sure about. There's some speculation that, for instance, the king's pool might be identified with the pool of Siloam, but we're not sure. And apparently the way that Nehemiah builds the city, it's much smaller than it was before the exile. And it's shaped differently than how Herod built it, how Herod put the city together. So if you're familiar with the topography of Israel, and I am not, I have not been there, it's apparently very hard to sort of picture what this would be like because it's so different now. Part of why he does what he does in secret is because we will learn later, we will have be told explicitly, but some of the officials are in league with the hostile neighbors, and they would not be on board with what Nehemiah is doing. These neighbors probably thought that they were doing what was in Israel's best interest. It's so interesting how, and possibly some of them did, and they did not see how God was working such that they got on board with the project. They weren't necessarily Ammonites in the way that Tobiah was. Some of them probably were, but it could have been just been the case that he did not know where alliances lay and how people were going to go, or he did know, and he just decided, you know what, I'm going to figure this out and I'm going to get people to be on my side, and then everyone else, they can sort of, I'm going to give myself as much time as I can to do what I'm going to do. All right. Then I said to them, you see the bad situation we are in, that Jerusalem is desolate and its gates burned by fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem so that we will no longer be a reproach. I told them how the hand of my God had been favorable to me and also about the king's words which he had spoken to me. Then they said, let us arise and build. So they put their hands to the good work. So Nehemiah approaches those who he had just said in the previous section that he hadn't told the people who were going to build what they were going to do. He approaches those he wants to help him build. He argues that since God has been so gracious to him, particularly in the way that he's interacted with the king and how the king has been responsive in a very positive way, that they can expect to succeed in rebuilding Jerusalem so that they aren't a reproach, so that they aren't embarrassed to be who they are. They, we are seeing that God does offer a sort of outward flourishing as a sign of his blessing. All right, so here we're going to go back to Sanballat. But when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official and Geshem the Arab heard it, they mocked us and despised us and said, "What is this thing you are doing? Are you rebelling against the king?" So I answered them and said to them, "The God of heaven will give us success. Therefore, we his servants will arise and build. But you have no portion, right or memorial in Jerusalem." So the way this scene is presented between Sanballat and Nehemiah, it's almost like these guys are sitting outside or around the gate just taunting Nehemiah. This seems to be a literary flourish. They're not specified in a place. So the substance of Nehemiah's interactions with these people, whether that was by letter or if they sent an embassy to him or he talked with somebody who ended up talking to them, however that worked out, the substance of that is what we get recorded here. But the way it's presented is just like, it's almost like they, you know, if you were presenting this on a stage, they just have a spotlight and then all of the people have an interaction. And you can't see the scenery or anything. It's just them there talking. And again, we see that they're mocking and they say, "What is this thing you are doing? Are you rebelling against the king?" It's almost as if Sanballat and Tobiah are threatening to start rumors about what Nehemiah is doing. Now, remember, this was the reason that they got permission from Artaxerxes to stop, not Sanballat and Tobiah, but previous folks had gotten permission to stop the Jews from building, is because they went to Artaxerxes and said, "Look, they're rebelling against you." So that is an old trick that they know works. And I mean, Nehemiah is far away. Who's to know? Maybe he's showing his true colors. And Nehemiah's reply is not concerned with the optics or the politics of what's going on. He says, "Look, the God of heaven is going to give us success. We're going to build. You guys don't have any part of this, right? You guys are obsessed with the optics and the politics. And you are not interested in what God is actually doing in history. And that's why you have no portion, right, or memorial in Jerusalem." Okay, so I'm just going to read through this next section. I do have some comments about it. This is mostly about the repairs. It is not scintillating. So just bear with me. "Then Eliashib the high priest arose with his brothers the priests and built the sheep gate. They consecrated it and hung its doors. They consecrated the wall to the Tower of the Hundred and the Tower of Hananel. Next to him the men of Jericho built, and next to them Zakur the son of Imri built. Now the sons of Hassena built the fish gate. They laid its beams and hung its doors with its bolts and bars. Next to them, Merimoth, the son of Uriah, the son of Hakoz, made repairs. And next to him, Meshullam, the son of Berechiah, the son of Meshezabel, made repairs. And next to him, Zadok, the son of Bana, also made repairs. Moreover, next to him, the Tekoites made repairs, but their nobles did not support the work of their masters." So the next several paragraphs, we're going to be talking about the repairs. I'm going to read through these sections. I might not have tons to say. I have some to say about this section we read. It seems their plan is to build the gates and the doors, which are built out of wood, and then to build the walls from gate to gate. And Nehemiah notes at one point that they managed to build it to half its height. And then presumably, as the narrative goes on, people are then building sort of from the top of the gate down, you know, building towards that. And they're sort of filling in the space so that you sort of end up with this sort of, you know, it's sort of going like this until they can fill in all the space and have the wall from gate to gate sort of done. There is a lot of technical language here. People make a lot of prepositions here. I'm just going to go with, it is enough for my purposes that there are people building stuff. And I have a couple of comments about some of the people. People will make much of a difference of preposition here or there. I'm not going to draw attention to those. Okay, so in general, the people who are rebuilding these sections of the wall have some kind of investment in that portion of the wall being built. So the sheep gate is where, presumably, the sheep are brought in to be sacrificed at the temple. Presumably it's close to the temple. So the high priests and priests are involved because that's related to their work. And this is true of a lot of people. It seems like people's residence or workplace is sort of immediately behind this wall or this gate or close to this gate. So they sort of build, they help in the construction because they have a vested interest in sort of getting gates and walls up. Also in this paragraph, it mentions this guy, Meremoth, the son of Uriah, the son of Hakoz. We know of Meremoth from earlier in Ezra. If you guys remember, he's the guy who had the silver and gold weighed into his hands when Ezra came with priests from Persia. Okay. We also know, and I noted this when we saw him getting the silver and gold weighed into his hand, that he was of a priestly line, but they couldn't confirm it, and they said that he could not be a priest until the Urim and Thummim, and you remember me stumbling over those, were restored. And so they must have been restored because he's acting as a priest. So Meremoth, we know, is a priest. Furthermore, the next name that appears on the list is Zadok, the son of Bana. Now, we don't know anything about Zadok, son of Bana. However, Zadok is the name of a famous priest, and it is not unusual to find people who have, you sort of keep ancestral names within the family. Now, I'm sure there might be an exception to this, so this is somewhat speculative. But my suspicion is that this Zadok, son of Bana, is also a priest. So we're in a section where we're talking about priests, and then we get this sentence. Next to him, the Tekoites made repairs, but their nobles did not support the work of their masters. So if we're talking about priests, then my assumption is that the Tekoites are either Levites or some kind of temple servant whose residence is in Tekoa. Tekoa is south of Jerusalem, my understanding is. Tekoa is really close to, they would have been sitting ducks for this guy Geshem the Arab. Okay, so they could have easily been attacked. This might have been the reason why their leaders were not the, it says their nobles. So my assumption there is that whatever they mean by their nobles, whoever was sort of leading them weren't on board with this project. However, there was a group of Tekoans who were sort of rogue Tekoans, Tekonites. There are these rogue Tekonites who were not following sort of the political aspirations of their leaders to come help with this reconstruction. And it says the nobles did not support the work of their masters. Who are their masters? Well, if they're Levites or temple servants, then their masters would have been the priests. And again, that's speculation and is dependent on Zadok actually being a priest. But I think what this illustrates, at the very least, whether I'm right about the Tekoites or not, it is clear that not all of Israel is in support of what's going on. We have people who have we know later, we get explicitly named people who are in have alliances. I think somebody has married like a son-in-law, you know, they have a son-in-law or something like that. Anyway, we know that there are relationships with folks like Tobiah. And so not people are invested in other places. They're not only interested in doing this project of the wall. Okay, I'm just going to read through the rest of this thing here. Joiada, the son of Paseah, and Meshullam, the son of Besodeah, repaired the old gate. They laid its beams and hung its doors with its bolts and its bars. Next to them, Melatiah, the Gibeonite, and Jadon, the Nethite. The men of Gibeon and of Mizpah also made repairs as far as the official seat of the governor of the province beyond the river. So, presumably, the official seat of the governor of the province beyond the river is a house that the governor lives in while he's in Jerusalem. And they build the wall until they get to that point. So there's a lot of language that's sort of like that. They built it to his house. Well, his house is further back from the, you know, but they've built the wall so that it sort of is now in, there is a wall in front of his house instead of, you know, a gap. Next to him, Uzziel, the son of Harhiah of the goldsmiths made repairs. And next to him, Hananiah, one of the perfumers made repairs. And they restored Jerusalem as far as the broad wall. Presumably gold and perfume are very valuable, so they would have had a vested interest in building walls to protect their stuff. And they restored Jerusalem as far as the broad wall. Next to them, Raphaiah, the son of Hur, the official of half the district of Jerusalem, made repairs. Next to them, Jediah, the son of Harumaph, made repairs opposite his house. And next to him, Hattush, the son of Hashbaniah, made repairs. Malchijah, the son of Harim, and Hashub, the son of Pahath-Moab, repaired another section and the Tower of Furnaces. Next to him, Shalom, the son of Halahesh, the official of half the district of Jerusalem, made repairs. He and his daughters. Hanan, the inhabitants, and the inhabitants of Zanoah repaired the valley gate. They built it and hung its doors and its bolts and its bars and 1,000 cubits of the wall to the refuse gate. Malchijah, the son of Rechab, the official of the district of Beth-Hakkerem, repaired the refuse gate. He built it and hung its doors with its bolts and its bars. Shalom, the son of Kolhoza, the official of the district of Mizpah, repaired the fountain gate. He built it, covered it, and hung its doors with its bolts and its bars, and the wall of the pool of Shelah at the king's garden as far as the steps that descend from the city of David. After him, Nehemiah, the son of Azbuk, different Nehemiah from our Nehemiah, official of half the district of Beth-Zur, made repairs as far as the point opposite the tombs of David and as far as the artificial pool in the house of the mighty men. After him, the Levites carried out repairs under Rehum, the son of Bani. Next to him, Hashabiah, the official of half the district of Keilah, carried out repairs for his district. After him, their brothers carried out repairs under Bavai, the son of Henadad, official of the other half of the district of Keilah, etc., etc., etc. I'm actually going to skip through until we get to the end of 3. It continues in this list. Some of these people do more work. You'll notice if you were just where a couple of sentences from where I left off, you'll see Meremoth, the son of Uriah, the son of Hakaz, who's that priest who got vetted by the Urim and Thummim. There's a Meshullam who does multiple repairs. You'll see the Tekoites at the very end of 27 repairs stuff. So we have people who are building more than one thing. Anyway, so they're building. I want to get through a little bit more. This is chapter 4. Now it came about that when Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, he became furious and very angry and mocked the Jews. He spoke in the presence of his brothers and the wealthy men of Samaria and said, "What are these feeble Jews doing? Are they going to restore it for themselves? Can they offer sacrifices? Can they finish in a day? Can they revive the stones from the dusty rubble, even the burned ones?" Now Tobiah the Ammonite was near him, and he said, "Even what they are building, if a fox should jump on it, he would break their stone wall down." So clearly we're getting mockery from Sanballat and Tobiah. It does seem very realistic that if someone starts making improvements on something that you're sort of opposed to, that you belittle it. Or that is a reaction that people can have. Okay, here, O our God, how we are despised. Return their reproach on their own heads and give them up for plunder in a land of captivity. Do not forgive their iniquity and let not their sin be blotted out before you, for they have demoralized the builders. So we built the wall, and the whole wall was joined together to half its height, for the people had a mind to work. So Nehemiah hears what Sanballat and Tobiah are saying. He has a short imprecatory prayer. He says, let them get what they deserve. It's one of the unfortunate realities of history that the outward signs of blessing don't, or cursing for that matter, don't always line up with the inner condition of people, and especially of nations. These people are cursed because they hate God. And Nehemiah is asking that it become manifest how God is really related to them. Okay, 4, 7, and 8. Now when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, the Ammonites, and the Ashdodites heard that the repair of the wall of Jerusalem went on and that the breaches began to be closed, they were very angry. All of them conspired together to come and fight against Jerusalem and to cause a disturbance in it. Okay, so now Sanballat and company have escalated. They're actually thinking about using violence against the Jews. Next section. But we prayed to our God, and because of them we set up a guard against them day and night. Thus in Judah it was said, the strength of the burden bearers is failing, yet there is much rubbish, and we ourselves are unable to rebuild the wall. As far as commentaries can tell, and I find this a very strange piece, apparently this is like Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, or Too Much Trouble the World. It's a song that they sang as they worked, and it's basically about their miseries. That seems very strange, but maybe this was a thing they did. And, you know, the slaves who originated Too Much Trouble the World were being oppressed. And, you know, I think bluegrass, which comes out of, parts of it come out of like the Rust Belt and stuff. You have people living in very hard conditions, and that those hard conditions can sort of lead to this kind of folk creativity. Maybe it's just telling us that that's what was going on. It's a very odd detail to include, I think. Okay. Next section. Our enemies said, they will not know or see until we come among them, kill them, or put a stop to the work. Then the Jews who lived near them came and told us 10 times, they will come up against us from every place where you may turn. Then I stationed men in the lowest parts of the space behind the wall, the exposed places, and I stationed the people and families with their swords, spears, and bows. When I saw their fear, I rose and spoke to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people. Do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses. Okay, so what seems to be happening is that Sanballat and his cronies are dispersing propaganda. They're dispersing this rumor where they say, you guys aren't even going to, you know, they're letting that slip to people so that these Jews who live near Sanballat and the other nations come to Jerusalem and tell them they're going to come and they're going to kill you and you're not even going to know what's going on. And it seems entirely possible that these folks who live near them are more sympathetic with the hostile neighbors than they are with the folks who are rebuilding Jerusalem. And he says they told us 10 times. They just keep coming and telling them over and over again. And it's interesting that Nehemiah's reaction is, okay, if this is what's going to happen, then we're really going to face it down. Okay, the enemies say they will attack. So Nehemiah organizes people as if to actually fight a real battle. He puts them in strategic places, and then he gives this speech where he says, look, God has given us this bit of real estate. We are doing the work that God honors, and we will have success even if we have to end up fighting. So, again, there are some ways to interpret Nehemiah where this is how you do leadership. This is how you strategize. And this is sort of like, they have their propaganda, so we have our propaganda. I don't think Nehemiah is propagandizing here. I think Nehemiah is actually ready to take on this fight. He is saying, look, they are threatening things that you hold dear, so fight them. And it's interesting that the way that Nehemiah matches propaganda is with real courage. All right, we just have a couple more paragraphs. When our enemies heard that it was known to us and that God had frustrated their plan, So apparently their plan is just to make them panic from these rumors. And they are not panicked because they decide that if it comes to fighting, they will fight. Then all of us return to the wall, each one to his work. From that day on, half of my servants carried on the work while half of them held the spears, the shields, the bows, and the breastplates, and the captains were behind the whole house of Judah. Those who were rebuilding the wall and those who carried burdens took their load with one hand doing the work and the other holding a weapon. As for the builders, each wore his sword girded at his side as he built, while the trumpeters stood near me. I said to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people, "The work is great and extensive, and we are separated on the wall far from one another. At whatever place you hear the sound of the trumpet, rally to us there. Our God will fight for us." So we carried on the work, with half of them holding spears from dawn until the stars appeared. At that time I also said to the people, "Let each man with his servant spend the night within Jerusalem, so that they may be a guard for us by day and a guard for us by night and a laborer by day." So neither I, my brothers, my servants, nor the men of the guard who followed me, none of us removed our clothes. Each took his weapon, even to the water. So the intent of the propaganda is to cow the Israelites into just kind of going about things as normal and stopping what they're doing. And their response is to bear arms and to continue doing the work that they know that they are supposed to be doing while being ready at any moment to fight with folks. Okay. I think I will go ahead. We only have a few minutes here, but I think I will go ahead and see if there are any questions and address those. I will talk about Nehemiah modeling himself after Joshua at a later time. He's going to continue to do that, so we can talk about that later. Okay. So Robbie asked, could the walls being broken down and burned be left over from Nebuchadnezzar? That is, they had never been repaired. It's possible. Some commentators go that way. We have evidence in the text, in Ezra 4, that the neighbors of Jerusalem come and stop them by force of arms. So we know that there's active violence against Jerusalem at some point in Israel's history after Nebuchadnezzar. So my inclination is to believe that the thing that is happening and the reason why Hanani is so distressed, and he translates it to Nehemiah, is because this is a new situation. I mean, obviously, Nebuchadnezzar didn't help. And it may be that they haven't done tremendous amounts of more destroying the neighbors, haven't done a lot more destroying. But my assumption is that the Jews have tried to do some work towards repair and that has been erased by their neighbors. So, yeah, the destruction from Nebuchadnezzar is still obvious, but I don't think that is what Hanani is referring to in this section. Okay, folks, thank you for your attention. And next week, we will see how, despite the outward signs that God is blessing them, that does not necessarily match the inner state of the people. All right. See you next week. Bye.